Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It's Ask Anything Wednesday, so we'll talk about what's on your mind. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Ask Anything Wednesday. We can talk about the Bible, theology, doctrine, church life, questions related to the Christian life. We'll talk about family life, issues related to marriage, family, you name it. Also, cultural issues, political issues, they're all fair. The number 877-893-8255, that's 877-893-TALK. At my website at albertmohler.com today, I posted an article entitled, Some Thoughts on the Reading of Books. I'm always glad to hear from you out there, especially listeners, as you write in with questions and comments. And one of the things I get repeatedly from listeners is, what about reading? How do I prioritize reading? How do I look at that? We're going to schedule a program very soon just to deal with that question. And I went ahead and published this article in hopes that it would help folks to think about perhaps how to read. I'll just admit that I love to read. And so it's no particular virtue that I read a lot. It is an exercise. It is preparation for the speaking and teaching and writing that I do. But I also just love to read. And I'm the kind of person that has to have a book sitting beside me in the car seat just in case I stop and I'm alone in the car and there's a red light. Maybe I can get a couple of paragraphs in. That may sound neurotic to some people, maybe even psychotic. But the reality is that the world is divided between those who are readers and those who really are not. And my hope is that more who are in the are not category can be moved into the avid reader category. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we need to understand that that as Christians, we love learning for the sake of our love of Christ. For the Christian, learning is a discipline of the Christian life. The most important things we can learn are those things about God himself, those things about Jesus Christ, those things about the great doctrines of the faith, deep knowledge of the Bible. But we also recognize that God has put us in this world and that his glory is found in this world. And so God's glory is found in the reading of the right kind of literature, even the right kind of fiction. And especially, I tell you, one of the things I love is reading history and historical biographies. At my website, Albert Mohler, that's MOHLER.com, the article is posted today on some thoughts on the reading of books. And I just make some initial suggestions about strategizing reading, from what fields. Then working through different kinds of reading as a Christian. What kind of things should you be concerned about? I'm going to be writing an article very soon on some missionary biographies that I recommend, because there's no way, I think, to really get in touch with a sense of the great missionary calling and commission of the church like reading the biographies of those great missionaries who've gone before, some giving their lives, other their entire lifetimes to this great cause. I suggest getting to know some authors really well. And really reading through an author, coming to understand it's not just one book, it's an entire approach. It's sometimes an entire body of thought, or it's an entire style and a form of writing or matter of interest that will interest you as well. I suggest you also read books for what they're worth. I mean, if you're reading a book that's not really important and in the middle of reading it, you figure out it's not really important, then drop it and go read something important. There's too much important reading out there to waste your time in what's not interesting to you or not helpful to you, not important for your life as a Christian, and just not worth your time. So if you've spent a few dollars on that book and it's not important, your time is more important than the money. Go find something. And find some people, some Christians who are reading, and find out what they're reading. I suggest you allow yourself some fun reading. And learn to read some enjoyable books. I think this is really important, parents, for children. I hear a lot of parents say, my kids don't like to read. Well, if they were given the stuff to read that your kids are given to read, maybe they wouldn't be excited about reading either. And I think this is especially true for boys. A lot of the stuff that boys are handed to read in school is fundamentally not interesting to them. Now, I'm not saying they're not accountable to read it. You make sure they read it. It's your parental responsibility to make sure they're learning. And if your son doesn't want to read this, you got to tell him that's his job to read it. But he's not going to be excited about reading the stuff he's got to read. He's going to be excited about reading the stuff he wants to stay up all night reading. And I can guarantee you that almost any boy can be encouraged that way if you find the right kind of literature. And I made some suggestions in a recent article. You can go to the website and find that. And I've got another article coming out very shortly on how to encourage boys and young men to read. The other thing I suggest is, remember that you're building a library with these books, and I don't mean a library like a big building and all the rest. You're just building a your own set of books. But don't think of it as a book collection. If it's a book collection, then you're going to polish them and keep them dusted, and you know you don't want anything to happen to them. I want things to happen to your books. I want them to show the wear of the fact you've been reading them. I want you to have a pen in your hand and or a pencil and for some people a highlighter and make marks in the books. Have a relationship with this book so that your learning is reflected in the book. Your thought is reflected in the book. Remember that we are spatial creatures. That means space is important to us. And actually making a mark in a book helps you to remember things. And I'm told that's especially important for the male brain. And since that's the only brain I know, I have to take that for granted. But that just might help some of you in reading. If you want to remember it and make some marks in it, have a conversation with the book. You'll find my article, Some Thoughts on the Reading of Books, at albertmuller.com, posted overnight. And I think you may find it interesting. It will be followed by other articles, similarly trying to help Christians think about how it is we are supposed to read. Big issues out there in the news. U.S. News and, in this case, USA Today is out with a big story headline, Young Adults Delaying Marriage. Data show dramatic surge in single 20-somethings. We've talked about that so many times in this program, but there is new data out there, and these new data really point to some issues that ought to have our attention. Census figures right now show that just 23.5% of men and only 31.5% of women aged 20 to 29 were married in the year 2006. Now, get this. The amount of change, and this is coming from Peter Morrison of the RAND Corporation, the think tank releasing this report, the amount of change in 6 years is quite substantial. Now, here's where I want to put in a footnote. The 2000 data from the census were alarming in this respect. I've written about this. I've been talking about it. Now we are told that 6 years later, the data are even more dramatic, that there's been that much of a shift in 6 years. Let me go back again. This is Peter Morrison of the RAND Corporation. He says, it's impressive in terms of the degree to which the institution of marriage is evolving. There clearly is a process of social evolution occurring here, and one can speculate about where it will end. Oh, yeah, let's speculate for a moment. Let's try to play that out. Where will it end? Well, it ends with more people delaying adulthood, more people delaying marriage. And the amazing thing is that they're delaying marriage over against all the trends of society past. In other words, when would such a thing have happened in previous centuries? During a time of want? Yes. During a time of poverty? Yes. During war, pestilence, famine? Yes. During a time of prosperity? No. By any measure, we're living in a great period of human prosperity. The big question is, why are we acting like we're living in a time of warfare, pestilence, or plague? In terms of marrying, why is it that so many young people aren't growing up? And again, I have to come back to young men. Here's the primary responsibility. I mean, they're not doing the asking, then they're not doing the marrying either. And, Diana West, in her book right now on Where Are the Adults, she makes a very interesting point, and this is backed up with the data. The majority, hear me again, the majority of Italian young men between the ages of 20 and 29 are living with their mothers. Now, that must be, as observers in Italy will now recognize, something altogether new in human civilization, where young men are living with their mothers rather than with wives. And, all I can say is, if you're living with your mother, and if this is a big cultural movement, somebody's not growing up and doing what adults do, which is getting married, having children, and fulfilling the responsibilities of adulthood. I have a feeling that may have stepped on a few toes, but maybe that may just start a little conversation in some of the right places as people try to think these issues through. Today is Conception Day in Russia. They're not officially calling it the Day of Conception. They're calling it the Give Birth to a Patriot Day. Russia's birth rate has fallen to disastrous levels, and that is matched with the fact that it has one of the lowest life expectancy spans of any nation. Right now, the average life expectancy for an adult male is about 56 years old. That's 20 years less than other nations in Europe and about 20 years less than the United States. So people are living shorter lifespans, and they're having very few babies. Right now, Russia has 140 million citizens, but In just a matter of about 40 years, that's likely to drop below 100 million. That will be social disaster for Russia. They can't keep everything going with a population that is that low. So they're giving workers today a day off to procreate. That tells you a whole lot about where we are. Russians giving a day off to procreate, and Italian young men living at home with mom. That's the world we live in, and we'll be back for intelligent conversation about this world and your issues on the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. 877-893-TALK with your question. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It's Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll get to as many questions as is possible. From Louisville, Kentucky, David's listening on WFIA. Go ahead, David.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. I really appreciate the program. I just wanted to ask for your help in kind of thinking through a married Christian man's work week and how much time he ought to spend at the office and be a good witness at the workplace and all the things that go along with that.
Yeah, David, you know, my first thought about that is that that has to be a contextual question in the sense that if for instance, throughout most of human history, the majority of people were in agrarian settings, in other words, they were farmers, you pretty much had to do what you had to do when you had to do it. And so the hours were really set by the stuff you had to do to make the farm work and plant the crops and reap the crops and all the rest. Then when you had the emergence of business in the house and where you had the dad was a blacksmith and or a tanner or a butcher or something like that, the family was living basically in the place of work. And so what's really important about that, David, is that work and dad and home weren't separate things. It was pretty much there. The kids were working with dad on the farm. Working in the fields. The sons were out in the fields and the daughters were largely with mom in the house learning the domestic world. And, that was largely true also in the world of the guilds, where you had all these people working in their homes. The factory changed all that, David. The Industrial Revolution changed all that. All of a sudden, dad's now packing his lunch and heading out the door to work. He's working like Ward Cleaver. You know, he used to say, go into the salt mines. And so now he's going somewhere else. So now work is something extraneous from the home and extraneous from the family. And that's why you're asking this question. It's because when you say how many hours should a man work, well, that question sometimes is set by the work. I mean, if you're a heart surgeon or if you're an obstetrician, you're going to get awakened in the middle of the night. And guess what? You can plan how much you're going to work, but you're going to end up working whatever the work is. And so then you have to figure out if you're in those positions, how in the world do I reserve the time where I can be with my family, because the family's not going to be in the operating room with you. The family's not going to be in the courtroom with the attorney these days. The family's not going to be in the classroom where the teacher is teaching in one of the schools. The teacher's not. The family's not going to be in the store or in the stockbroker's office or just about anywhere else. And so now we have a real challenge to figure out how to balance this with family life. And, you know, David, I don't know that there is a number I can give here. I'd be honest and say if I thought 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 hours is the key, I would say it. But I don't think there is a number. I think the big issue is to remember that God has not called a man, a Christian man, to be a failure in any dimension of his calling. And so as we are both, well, I say both, it's going to be more than two, as we are worker and citizen and churchman, and then so very importantly, husband and father, that really means we've got to figure out how all those things, because it's not just how much should we work at the job over against spending time with our family, but also contributing to the life of the church. And so this is where I think we have to be in the fellowship again. And this is where so many times, especially in Ask Anything Wednesday, I come back and say, I can point to some principles here, maybe some framework for thinking, but I'd really encourage you to get together with some faithful Christian brothers who know you, know your job, know your wife, know your kids, know your responsibilities to the church, and can help you to think this through. And this kind of reality check among Christian men should be as natural as the New Testament. To just say, how am I doing here? You know, brothers, help me. Am I working too much here? Am I neglecting my children? Am I perhaps neglecting work and doing other things I shouldn't be doing? I think that that's where it really has to come down to the fact, again, God's not calling a man. God wouldn't call us to do these multiple things and then expect us to fail in them. He expects us to find a way to do them all faithfully. And sometimes that requires some changes, maybe even a change job. You can't change your wife. You can't change your kids. That's scripturally clear, but you can change some other things perhaps in your life. David, is that at all helpful?
That was very helpful, Dr. Muller. Thanks a lot.
All right. We really appreciate the call. And one of the things that encourages me today, I got all kinds of questions up here that I've never heard before on this program, and that's exciting. David is going to be followed by Jim calling from Lakeland, Florida. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes. If a deacon is having children that are having children out of wedlock, of course, by accident, should he resign his position from being a deacon? Or what do you think about that?
How old would this child who had the baby be?
It would be living underneath his roof,
right.
Possibly just out of high school or right there about.
Yeah, that is very, very important. Let's go to 1 Timothy 3. And let's just get the key biblical text here in mind. And this is about the elder, and it's followed by the passage about the deacons. So let's just go to the deacons first. It says, deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. When it's talking about elders, it mentions that they are to manage their own household. And that's why the deacons follow immediately from that, saying likewise. It says here about the elder that he must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Okay, so we put all that together. And certainly the requirement made of elders here, of those who would be the pastors and teachers of the church, that they must have their household in good order. And it says here, managing the household well, keeping children under control with all dignity. That doesn't mean that his children will not sin. You know, there's not a pastor, elder, or deacon whose children do not sin. And so we recognize that's going to happen. The question is the household under control, knowing that you're talking about the control one can have over sinners? How is he responding to this? I think that's the big issue. Just consider this. Given those biblical criteria, is the way this deacon is responding to this a testimony to the gospel, a testimony to the discipline of the church? Has he come before the church to say, here is the issue, and I'm going to provide the spiritual leadership as a dad to come before the church and the elders of the church, the deacons of the church, the ministers of the church, and seek to handle this in a Christian way? I'm saying I don't think there's a black and white answer to that question. But if this deacon is in any way covering his child's sin, denying his child's sin, and forfeiting and abdicating the role of the father and of the Christian leader in this, there's a big problem. And so that I think, is the clearest thing I know to say, especially when it's a child in the home, a minor child under his authority, and thus, in a very special relationship there. I think it is a bit different when someone's left the household because they're no longer under the authority of the father, and the father can't be held accountable for what his children may do when he no longer has any control or leadership over them. Jim, does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It clarifies it. It sure does.
Well, that's great. And as you're thinking about this and praying about this in your church, I would just go back to that 1 Timothy 3 passage again and again and realize, and I need to make this point, realize that there are times and seasons in the life of a man when he may need to step back from this leadership in order to be the leader he needs to be at home. It's not so much punitive in saying, you don't deserve to be a deacon in this church anymore. It can be very brotherly to say, you really need to give primary attention right now to being the leader in your home to help your family get through this crisis. And that can be a testimony to the gospel as well. I mean, that's one of the most important things. You know, there are an awful lot of Christians who think that their fellow Christians won't sin. Well, don't hold to that illusion, because you're going to be stripped of it catastrophically. The issue is, how does a Christian respond to that sin? Number one, we have to respond to that sin by naming it for what it is. We can't be dishonest about it. We can't cover for it. We have to come before our brothers and sisters with the absolute honesty that that's what this sin is. Then let's figure out how we deal with it. Number one, we take it to the cross, where we know it can be forgiven. And then we deal responsibly with its consequences. And one of those consequences is the impact of this sin and its aftermath on the gospel ministry and on individual reputations. The glory of the gospel in Jesus Christ and all this is not that sin doesn't happen, but in seeing how Christ triumphs over sin in his church. Back with more questions on Ask Anything Wednesday. This is the Albert Muller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to Ask Anything Wednesday on the Albert Mohler Program. To call with your question, just reach us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Holding what might be the record for holding for waiting a question on this program is Mike the Patient Man in Jonesboro, Tennessee. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, Dr. Mohler, thanks for taking the call. In light of recent events in my church, I'm wondering what your thoughts and opinions are on a pastor being an elder at the church.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Mark. I'm trying to figure out a little bit about where it comes from, because as I read the New Testament, if anyone's an elder, the pastor is. Can you tell me something about where this question comes from your church?
The pastor at our church right now was nominated to be an elder, and we go through a voting process there. And he was affirmed by the congregation overwhelmingly to be an elder at our church, but that the people that did not apparently vote for him has been upset about it and has caused a couple of people to withdraw themselves from their roles at that church as elder and as minister.
What kind of denomination is this, or is it an independent church?
It's a Church of Christ.
Yeah. You know, I am not a specialist on the Church of Christ by any means, but I think I can answer this from the New Testament, Mark. I think there are perhaps some confusions here. I believe that the pastor is the one person, according to the New Testament, the pastor of the church, who is both bishop and elder. And the elder's responsibility is to teach. And I would be very concerned about a church government in which you had elders who are ruling without responsibility to teach. Because I think it's the teaching office that's most important. As a matter of fact, go back to 1 Timothy 3. I mean, that's where we began. You know, able to teach is what is so important here. Being able to do these things, having the responsibility to be a teacher of the church. So, you know, that's where I have to come back and say, Mark, so far as I understand from the New Testament, if anyone's an elder, first of all, and of course there are, it would be the pastor and those who have the congregationally recognized, God-called gift and responsibility of teaching. And, you know, there are some interesting debates going on in the Southern Baptist Convention and in other denominations about who you call what and how you assign these things. And, you know, if you're just looking at the New Testament as clearly as possible, I think you understand that the elder is one who has responsibility to teach. And it's the teaching office, especially the Bible teaching, preaching office, that is where the leadership is to come from in the church. That doesn't mean that no one's to be in that leadership team, you might call it, the board of elders, if that's what you call it in your church, who is not an ordained minister. Ordination's not the issue here. But the issue is having the biblical gift to teach, because that's where the responsibility of the church should lie. Mark, it sounds to me like maybe this is an issue that has some particular dimensions to it, the Church of Christ, of which I might be unaware, and I just need to admit that. But as I read the New Testament, the question's just a little angular. Because if I were to look to my church and say, where's the elder? And my church doesn't even call anyone an elder. I think you'd first recognize that it would be the pastor and those who bear the responsibility to teach who are fulfilling the role of the elders in the church. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Dawn calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Dawn.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Mohler, for taking my call today. I was responding to the earlier comment you made about the boy culture and some recent articles you have written, and also adding to, I guess, to the mess is I firmly believe there's a spiritual undertow to basically demasculize, I might have botched that word up, but take male out of society.
Yeah.
And firmly that is going to affect marriage, because women don't act like women anymore. Men don't act like men anymore. So I see this in movies, advertising, literature. I was an English major in college. I was disgusted by about 90% of what I was taught. So as a Christian and as a single Christian woman who is wanting to go for the ultimate glory here, how as a church do we respond to this type of worldview, or, you know, how does the church respond to something like this to, either encourage or even bring back society.
Yeah, I would say that our ability to confront the society on this is a secondary question. Our first issue ought to be how we address ourselves. And Don, I could think of many long ways to answer your question, but I would say the first thing is it needs to be preached from the pulpit. It needs to be the expectation of the church. It needs to be reinforced through parents raising their children, especially their sons. And in the church, we need godly older men counseling and encouraging and exhorting younger men, even as we have older women instructing and encouraging and, let's just use a modern word, mentoring younger women. And those young men and young women, the men first, need to be encouraged towards marriage and adulthood. Right back with your questions. I'm Albert Mueller. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. To call with your question, just reach us at 877-893-8255. Call 877-893-TALK. And your question could be next in line from Buchanan, West Virginia. Zach's listening on the World Wide Web. Go ahead, Zach.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. My question is gluttony a sin? And if so, is it as bad as others?
Wow, great question. Is gluttony a sin? Question number one. Two, if so, is it as bad as others? First of all, is gluttony a sin? Well, it's not a good thing. We know that. Scripture never speaks positively of it. There are several points in Scripture where gluttony is listed among the faults of a person. And just to take a little brief review of how gluttony is mentioned in the Bible, for instance, you have clear, very direct references in the book of Proverbs, Proverbs 23:21. Gluttons come to poverty. That's a very clear sign of judgment. So a glutton is one who eats to excess, and that's its very definition. And the eating to excess is the problem. We're told that that a young man is not to be, the wise man is not a companion of gluttons, doesn't hang around with them. In Deuteronomy chapter 21, verses 18 through 21, you have rules about a rebellious son. And one of the things that the parents of a rebellious son are to say to the city is, "This our son is a stubborn and rebellious son. He will not obey our voice. He is a glutton and a drunkard." Well, you just put that whole thing in line, and Zach, it's clear. It's a negative judgment being made here. Is it a sin? Yes, it is. And by the way you just look at this, you have glutton and drunkard put together. What's a drunkard? Well, we know what that is. And so a glutton similarly eats as a drunkard drinks. And so here's the issue. If you look at food is one of God's great gifts to us, but it's to be enjoyed to God's glory in its proper proportion. Now, for an honest just revelation here, most of us today would be gluttons by any standard of times past. We eat more than times past. Just look at how the serving size has grown in restaurant life just over the last 20 years. There are good measures of how eating habits have changed, and it's all changing with people eating a lot more. But gluttony is certainly a sin when it can get to compromise our health and our witness and all the rest. So, Zach, is it a sin? I have to say it's a sin. It's not mentioned in other catalogs like this. It's not in the Ten Commandments. It's not found there. It is instead in the total picture of what it means to live to the glory of God, enjoying all of God's gifts in proper proportion. We get them out of proportion, we have a problem. There'd be a problem in refusing to eat to the glory of God when we need to eat for nutrition and for fellowship. But there's also a sin the other way. Is it as bad as others? Well, that gets back to the fact that every single sin is an infinite assault upon the infinite holiness of God. So, Zach, a very important principle here is that every sin is infinite over against the holiness of God. So in that sense, no sin is any worse than any other. But the Bible also tells us that the consequences of sin, the earthly consequences of sin, are not equal. Certainly murder does not have an equal consequence as shoplifting. And certainly drunk driving doesn't have an equal consequence as a speeding ticket where there's no accident. So consequences can be different, even as every single sin, no matter what it is an insult to the infinite holiness of God. And therefore, every single sin, whether it is what someone might say merely gluttony or premeditated murder, every single sin is a denial of God's authority and affront to his holiness. A denial of his glory, that's what Romans 1 tells us, and thus worthy of death. So gluttony would be enough to kill us, Zach. It'd be enough of an assault upon the glory of God. It'd be enough to send us to hell, but for the grace and mercy of God. But in its effect, it certainly has some bad effects on health and witness and all the rest, but it's not the same in its effect as some other sins. Zach, I hope that helps. That's a great question. And interestingly, one that I don't think I've ever heard before on this program. Michael's calling from Houston, Texas. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, Dr. Mueller. My wife and I have different theological presuppositions about certain things like salvation and certain things like that. How do I go about handling that in a biblical manner?
That is a great question, Michael. You have a God-given responsibility to teach. As a matter of fact, your wife is told to submit to your authority. And one of the most important issues in that authority is teaching. And this is where I would really encourage you lovingly, consistently, and strategically to try to bear witness to your wife through your teaching and through your life of why you believe what you believe. And then I would also encourage you to make sure you're in a gospel congregation that is committed to the scripture and to its full authority and to the gospel, and be in the company of fellow men who are in the same responsibility that you are, bear the same responsibility that you have, and be in conversation with them about how you can be faithful in this. I don't think any one of us is smart enough to figure how we can be faithful in all of this. You know, Michael, you ask a question that just leads me to say, you know, when you think about compatibility, and the secular world talks about hoping that couples will be compatible, you know, some of them are talking about sexual compatibility, personality compatibility. You know, an awful lot of these inventories that are taken in premarital counseling and all the rest, and some of these internet dating services, it all comes down to assuming that being compatible means that you share the same personality and interests and hobbies and all the rest. The most important compatibility is a spiritual compatibility. And, Michael, I really admire your question, and I admire the way that you are serious about this in wanting to fulfill your responsibility as a husband. And I would just encourage you, lovingly, consistently, patiently, and strategically, to teach by your actual teaching and articulating these things and defending them and explaining them, and by your life, that that these things are true. Michael, I hope that helps, and thanks for your call from Houston. We're always glad to get your questions sent in by email. Andrew sent in a question: how come Jews no longer sacrifice animals? Should they? Well, now, that's a very good question. The answer to that is no, they should not, but they don't know it. Now, that may sound a little bit confusing. Let me put it this way. The Bible tells us that when Jesus Christ died on the cross, that the curtain in the temple was torn from the bottom to the top. That was a symbol of the fact that Jesus Christ was himself on the cross, the last sacrifice for sin. The book of Hebrews lays this out poetically, beautifully, and forcefully. The sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ means that there is no other need for the sacrifice of any animal. As the writer of Hebrews says, he went into the Holy of Holies not with the blood of an animal, but shedding his own blood. But the Jews who rejected him still continued animal sacrifices, and they continued until the destruction of the temple in A.D. 70. So the reason why no animal sacrifices is because the temple is not now in Jerusalem. And from A.D. 70, in the first century forward, Jews have had to find a different way of worship and a different approach to life. That's why you have the division between temple Judaism and what's now called rabbinic Judaism. So that's why the sacrificial system ended. But it should not have ended in 70 A.D. with the destruction of the temple. It should have ended on that day, long before that, when Jesus Christ paid the full penalty for our sins on the cross. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Wouldn't you love to be able to sing like that? That is tenor Mark Padmore singing the new album, As Steals the Morn. It's a recording of George Frideric Handel's arias and scenes. It's a new thing. There's kind of been a renaissance of Handel recordings of late. And at my website at albertmueller.com, this morning I started a new feature that's going to be continuing. It's entitled The Discerning Ear. And I've been encouraged to hear from listeners out there who have said, I appreciate your references to music. What do you recommend? Now, I'm not saying that the only kind of music you should listen to is classical music. I'm just privileging classical music above everything else. George Frideric Handel is best known among evangelicals for his great oratorio known as Messiah. And we often hear it, especially the respective parts at the Christmas and resurrection seasons. But when you're thinking about Handel, you need to realize that this is a man who wrote hundreds of pieces of music. And the same artistic gift that he employed so well in Messiah, he employs elsewhere. Oratorios on Judas Maccabeus and Samson and others. And Mark Padmore is a tenor who's able to sing so many of these really high songs, the arias and scenes, and to sing them without any shrillness and without any strain. And he's accompanied by the English Concert, which is a very fine Renaissance and Baroque ensemble. I want to recommend this piece to you. And I want to ask this question of you. It was 300 years ago that Handel wrote his first oratorio. 300 years later, you have a recording like this coming out of his music. It is music that is a testimony to the order of God's creation and to the incredible power of music to evoke emotion and memory. How much of today's music, or will any of today's music, be recorded and appreciated 300 years from now? I'm not saying don't listen to anything modern. I'm just saying, remember that classical music got there the hard way. It earned it by reputation. And it reflects an orderliness in God's creation and a respect for God's glory in creation that you're not going to find in many other genres of music. And when it comes to Handel, especially in his biblical oratorios, you have some of the clearest biblical testimony. One of my favorite sections of this particular CD is where Handel reflects Samson's experience of blindness as total eclipse. You'll hear Samson declare himself, quote, all dark amidst the blaze of noon. It's one thing to hear that in the spoken voice. It's another thing to sing it in a voice that can beautifully sing those same words. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Go to my website at albertmuller.com for these and other resources, and I'll meet you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.